You're listening to the 21st Century Change Agent Show. This podcast is for those who are always looking for ways to grow as a person and as a leader. On this show, you'll find no ordinary conversations, as I will be speaking with unique people who are already rewriting the narrative. My name is Barbara Ziga, and I help companies to achieve more by putting their people first. Head to Lake House Consulting website to find out more and subscribe to a bite-sized, hand-picked newsletter from me. Thank you for tuning in and get ready to receive your weekly dose of inspiration. Hi everyone, and thank you for tuning in to another Friday Change Agent episode with me. First of all, I would like to thank all of the new subscribers to my weekly bite-sized newsletter. And there has been many of you over the past few weeks, and I'd just like to say I appreciate you and your support, and I hope you enjoy the material I curate for you. For those who have not yet subscribed, the link is in the show notes, so make sure you do. You can also find me on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. So join my community there and drop me a hello. I've received a lot of praise and comments for this podcast series so far, so I'm really feeling the love, and thank you all for that. Right, so this episode is a special one because we'll be talking about bringing play back into our lives, both personal and professional. The 9-to-5 culture doesn't really exist anymore. Little by little, the boundaries that protect our leisure time are being eroded. Even more so now when we perform most of our daily activities from the same space. This kind of work-life imbalance, alongside with the anxieties that the pandemic has brought, are seeing depression and stress-related illnesses increase. According to a new report by King's College London and the London School of Economics, depression now costs European workplaces the equivalent of $120 billion a year. The greatest economic losses through absenteeism and lost productivity. In her book, Bridget Shorter explores how we've forgotten to play because we put too much onus on being productive. In another study by Brigham University, teams that played a collaborative game together for just 45 minutes were able to increase their productivity on a task by 20%. So there is a lot of undeniable, scientifically proven correlation between play and increased productivity, innovation and sense of community, and reduced stress levels. So why are we not seeing more companies weaving play into their cultures? This is a conversation I will be exploring with Cephas Howard on today's episode. Cephas has spent the last 12 years at Lego, with his most recent role as the head of innovation and digital play. He's currently the chief play officer at the Play Institute, where he furthers the development of products, insights, methods and practices relating to play. He helps companies integrate playfulness and innovation into their designs and experiences, developing and launching new products and facilitating play, learning and creativity within business environments. Ultimately, Cephas is one person who knows a thing or two about play. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Cephas on bringing play back into our lives, as right now I think we all need a little bit of that. Well, hi Cephas, and thank you so much for coming onto the Change Agent Show. I'm really looking forward to speaking with you, and most importantly, getting inspired to get involved in more fun and games in a professional setting. So welcome on the show. It's really exciting to have you here.
Thanks very much, Biba, and thanks for having me on the show. I'm very happy to be here.
So a little background story for the listener. Cephas and I connected not too long ago. It was during the time when Swedish retailer IKEA posted a job under a title of Chief Play Officer, and this was December 2020. I thought the title was fascinating. And also there was a caveat. There was no adult applications allowed. The role was strictly open for children aged 4 to 12. And this newly created Chief Play Officer role would be in charge of testing new toys before they launch into IKEA stores. Brilliant. Now, at the same time, I also noticed Cephas, who's obviously a full-on adult, also having the chief play officer title. And I was intrigued to explore this in more detail. So first and foremost, Cephas, I think you've got the most amazing title. So could you tell us a little more about your life's work and your journey into the role you are today?
Yes, of course. And I also noticed the advert you saw for IKEA and was wonderful to see it. For me, myself, I've been in the world of play. I kind of believe my whole life. I think what I mean by that is that we all start there. We all play as children, at least most of us get the fortunate opportunity to do so. But for many of us, we kind of grow out of it. I think it's kind of a societal thing, really, where we are kind of told to kind of give up our childish ways, right? You at some point, you become an adult. And we are kind of encouraged that play is then actually not a particularly good use of our time, or it's kind of it's a luxury we can't always afford, or many of these kinds of messages are sent our way. However, some of us, myself included, basically resist that on all fronts and actually feel that actually while you play, you not only learn, but you engage, and actually you can make everything more playful. And actually I set about from a very early age to pursue that path. I actually opened a toy shop when I was 13 and ran that for the summer holidays, 2-3 months while I was in between school years, as a kind of expression of that. And I always believed that I could have a career in basically play and playful thinking and ideation. And back then, that was not such a kind of accepted or easy to follow path. There were none of the special degrees or paths that there are existing today for kids to lead into or to follow. That kind of led into many different explorations. And finally, I kind of followed what was a lifelong ambition from, I suppose, about age 8. I remember asking my dad, I was a big fan of Lego already, from an old big box of bricks that we had a hand-me-down. And I said, Dad, does someone design Lego toys as like a job? And and he just said, yes, I suppose they do. And I was just like, what the? I think my mind was just blown, because at that point and where I was structured and set up, and I was very playful and surrounded by all these wonderful craftspeople where my parents ran a business. But at the same time, I kind of still considered jobs like, you know, there was the guys that the policeman, my dad, one of my friend's dads was a policeman, or like a fireman, or like, you know, the school teachers, or, you know, that was kind of still this kind of very, you know, understanding of kind of jobs, or kind of like these kind of clear professions that you understood. And the idea of somebody actually being paid to design toys was, you know, made sense after you thought about it. But at the time I was just like mind blown. And again, at that time, there wasn't really a clear path as to how you then got to do such a thing. But I kind of started inventing and playing around, and I always kind of like dreamt about that from that point onwards. And later I actually started moving into kind of game design. I started designing board games and card games and playing them with my friends and stuff, and then video games and so forth. But that never kind of went away. And then later, after a degree I did in creative imaging, which was about kind of advertising meets marketing, graphic design, photography, copywriting, all of these things like merged together, understanding that they all are interlinked in any of those disciplines. And that was up in Huddersfield in the north of England. And then I ended up in a job at the Guardian and Observer newspapers in London, and worked very much on new forms of advertising and media and communication, involving I actually often think about it as gamification, which was kind of how could you make this information more engaging and more playful, and speak to the reader in a different way, in a more playful way. And we did lots of fantastic projects there before I finally got my dream job from a child. And I applied and got the job of concept designer to go and work at Lego. And so that was kind of the beginning of the next chapter of my kind of playful journey, as it were. When I left Lego and I started my own company, I really kind of wanted to both state kind of what was my intention with what I wanted to pursue after that. And that was kind of, it took some thinking to come up with and settle on the Play Institute. And the reason for that was obviously the play was where I've always kind of been and focused. And the Institute aspect was really to think about it, to say that it's to kind of put that other aspect to play, right? So it's not about being serious, but or that players learning, or but actually it was more about kind of purposeful play, right? And how, and thinking beyond just the pure fun aspect of play, and into how can you be clever with play to actually achieve the wonderful things in products and experiences and procedures and actually companies. So I think the Play Institute kind of tried to kind of settle that. And then within that, what was my title? What was my role? And that's where, for me, I'd always never quite settled on any of these kind of, you know, CMO, COO, you know, sort of aspects I'd come across in my career. I always kind of felt, particularly having been at Lego, that there should have been like a chief play officer. And so with my own company, I was able to say, I put a flag in the sand and say, you know, this should be a thing, right? It should not just be about product or digital or experience, but actually play is such a cornerstone, or can be such a cornerstone to all experiences and products, that a chief play officer should be a thing. So I kind of, back in end of 2018, I kind of started up and called myself that, and have been happy to see it kind of spring up in other places since.
That's brilliant. That's a wonderful journey, and it sounds like it's a passion that's been sort of that you follow through from cradle to today, and you're still very much engaged and enjoying that kind of work. So thank you for sharing the story. You know, and there are, you know, quite a few things I'd like to unpack and explore with today, especially when it comes to play in a work environment, when it comes to play in, you know, digital spaces, in hybrid spaces, and how organizations can today bring that into their organizations and into their businesses and engage their people through that. So, but first and foremost, you know, what happened to that effortless joy in our daily lives, you know, the fun of play as children? You know, nearly everyone starts out life in playing just quite naturally with whatever's available, exactly what you just talked about. You know, we make up rules, we invent games, we fantasize, we imagine mysteries and treasures. You know, at what point and why do we lose this superpower?
So from my belief and understanding, and my kind of experience from my own kind of life, and actually those of others I've spoken to, and like I said, spending a lot of time in the worlds of play, I kind of have my own theories. And for me, I think there's a counterbalance to play and fear. So I kind of, we are actually born innately playful. We really are. You can see it in animals, in creatures, in children. They don't need to be taught how to play. It just comes innately. And conversely, we are born without any fear. We learn fear. We learn the fear of the dark. We learn the fear of abandonment. We learn the fear of falling. All of the fears that we gain through life, we are taught and learnt. And I believe that they are counterpoints to the ability to play. So as we kind of go through life and kind of gain fears and they get deep rooted, it makes it harder to do some of the key aspects of what's required for play. And actually talking to the business aspect, these are kind of interlinked towards creativity, play and innovation and all these things, because they also require you to have the freedom and the without the fear of failing or the fear of punishment or ridicule or any other of these other fears that we have, the list is honestly so long, that we need to have a freedom from this, which you can often get through play. When you play and you truly play with alone or with others, you literally, for a small period of time or however long you're playing, you set aside these fears. You are in like you said yourself, a make-believe world or another place, or it could be a board game. There's a construct. While you're playing that game, you are player one or blue or whatever. You are not quite yourself. So blue player can be mean and like try and win the game or completely send their armies in and destroy red player or whatever. And it's not meant to be taken personally. Often we do, but it's not meant to be taken personally. It's the construct of the game. As long as you're playing within the rules, then it is permissible. So you can often see people change quite dramatically when you play games with them, because this weight comes off and this opportunity opens up for them to kind of express themselves in ways that they don't feel comfortable doing in kind of a work situation or kind of polite society or whatever sort of culture they exist within.
I love that. And I just want to echo what you just said, you know, the play fosters innovation. It fosters creativity. It unites team members and really lets us bring more of ourselves to work, which is a huge D&I topic at the moment, which is a huge focus of organizations right now that are looking to create spaces of belonging or sense of belonging, sense of community. So it sounds like, you know, play or gamification in any way, it should be an absolute no-brainer. And also, I believe that if an organization is seen as a playful, fun place to be, it naturally attracts better and more energized talent. And while we are on sort of while we are sort of alluding into the sort of topic of organization, you know, we often hear people say business has to be fun. And when we think about play in a workplace, we often associate it with a physical infrastructure, you know, a ping pong or a pool table, perhaps a PlayStation or Xbox console somewhere in a breakout room. However, with the global lockdowns, with isolation and burnout and anxiety that follows, I doubt that many call their workplaces fun right now. You know, can we talk about the concept of play in business and what that actually means? And how can we detach that from the physical infrastructure and start bringing it into the new sort of remote and hybrid environments that we are in right now?
Yeah, of course. And I think you're right to say that often companies try to say, okay, you know, how can we make work more fun or kind of make things more playful? And that can indeed often end up in like adding a ping pong table or a table foosball table, or like you said, breakout rooms, which, although I'm not saying they're wrong or bad, they are not a solution in the way of the, from the, as I see it, the problem that was presented. So because of course, if you stop working and go and play ping pong for a bit, you have not made work more fun. You have just taken a break, right? You have stopped working and now you are playing a game, and then you resume working. So, do you see the difference? If you then construct work as the hours from 9 to 5 while you are at the office, then you could say, yes, now that actually I spend 20 minutes or 40 minutes a day playing ping pong or these other things while at work, work is now more fun. But I would believe that if you really wanted to take play and gamification and these types of things to improve work, then you should actually be improving those that time when you're at your desk or when you're in a meeting space or when you're actually doing the work, rather than taking a break from it. And I believe that there are ways that you can do these things. But one of the biggest challenges is not the ability to make these situations better or more playful, but actually this cultural resistance to the fact that if you are in a meeting or if you are at your desk supposed to be working, then anything seen as playing is a contradiction. So if you are playing, then clearly you are not working. And this is an old mindset and something I believe from kind of the Industrial Revolution and other things, where this construct of work is not play. Work is serious, play is frivolous. And we are still burdened with that. It's a hangover that we have. And what's the worst thing about it is that it's fundamentally wrong on all levels, because the more we are enjoying an activity, the more we are being playful, the better we will complete the task, the better we will immerse with the task, the more creative or passionate we will be about it, and of course the more we learn while doing it. So if you say all of those things, of course that would only improve productivity or a product or an experience or even just the work itself. So this idea that it's actually a negative thing is I believe fundamentally wrong.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And we'll unpack that in a little bit more detail. So one of the things that you talked about, and before I go into that, I just want to cite a piece of study that was carried out by University of Warwick recently, which ultimately reveals that employee satisfaction and productivity are unquestionably linked. And also a new report by King's College London and the London School of Economics have done research that concluded that depression now costs European workplaces the equivalent of $120 billion a year. And what we also know is that, you know, therapy is often referred for depression and anxiety. So now there is a psychological state called the flow, in which a person is stimulated, alert, present, and fully immersed in nothing but the task at hand. And in this state, learning and creativity are at optimum level. Time seems to fly and the person feels totally satisfied. And this is the state that is induced in children and adults by playful activities. And engaged in a task where process and pleasure override product and pressure. And the person sort of loses that sense of ego, and worry and anxiety are also reduced. So ultimately, we could conclude that play is therapy. And obviously, at the moment, organizations are investing massively in their work environment, mental well-being and healthcare, and those sort of things. And we have talked a little bit about the benefits of play in an adult life through innovation, seeing better patterns, potentially creativity. But how do you approach this topic when you work with organizations? What do you tell organizations about taking play at work more seriously rather than seeing it as a distraction, inappropriate, or a time wasting activity that has nothing to do with, quote unquote, the real work? How do you get organizations to realize that? And potentially maybe you've got any good examples from your experience where by sort of bringing play into the workplace that has really, really tapped into some untapped potential.
Yeah, I think that, as you said, play can be like a form of therapy too. But I actually think that what it also is actually the best form of preventative medicine. If you are being more playful in your work and in your life in the first place, there is a much smaller need for therapy in the back end. So I think that just like in terms of being healthy and exercising, we say 20 minutes of getting your heart rate up and exercising each day, or we say eating healthy, all of those are much better than waiting till you have a problem from lack of exercise or bad diet and then trying to fix that with medicine or other things at the other end. The same is true of stress, anxiety, depression and these aspects when related to work and other things. If you can make things lighter and more enjoyable in the first place, or enjoying the thing, you will have a lot less to deal with at the other end. So that's one aspect, I would say, a reason to bring some more playful and some lighter tone to the workspace. As some examples of this, I think some of the simpler ways in, and unfortunately, I'll reference some of these that do work, but unfortunately, I think that you'll see in a second when I mentioned that they don't always unfortunately carry through. So this is an example from Lego. What we would do often with each year as you form like a team, so you might be on the Star Wars team, or you might be on the Lego City team, or all these different sort of teams. And these teams, there are some people that stay on these teams for many, many years. There are others that change all the time, like regularly. So each time when you start to say you're going to do, it could be a, you know, a year-long process or a nine-month-long process of developing those products for that year, you need to kind of form a team. And so what they might would often do is these things called kickoffs, and often these would be off-site, again, pre-COVID. And you would gather the team together, and you would have some like fairly serious talks about what was going to happen that year, and some presentations. But there was, that was kind of maybe 10, 20% of it. 80% of it was basically having fun and bonding together as a group of people who were then going to produce playful and fun products. And that those were always kind of some of the highlights for everybody working there of the year. And they kind of really did that job well of kind of playfully bringing people together over, you know, food and play and activities, and really kind of melding them together as like, you know, we are a team and we are going to create fun, playful things this year. I think that that worked, and it takes you great energy into the start of that project in that year. And I think that a bigger challenge is to then maintain that and keep that flowing throughout the year in a way that is both structured and unstructured, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it totally does. And I really liked where you talked about play being a preventative medicine. And I think that is something that I would definitely would like to highlight in this podcast as well. And the other thing around sort of, you know, play being, you know, place for or an activity for bonding that creates a sense of belonging and community. And it's quite interesting. I recently listened to a podcast with Jane McGonigal, who is a PhD game designer. And she talked about the cultural currency for playing games and playing what effect playing games has got on children and teenagers. But I think what she talked about is quite applicable to also adults and professional life. And what she said is that, for instance, kids who played games before a pandemic and were in this virtual environment that, you know, often parents don't approve of, they actually coped better with the isolation and lockdowns because they were already part of this community. And of course, you know, all of this has to be in moderation because there is, you know, huge screen times as it is. And she was talking about the fact that when it comes to sort of these digital environments and video games, so 3 hours a day is optimal, or she was talking about sort of 21 hours a week is optimal. But they're also, you know, we always have to be sort of aware of the triggers, any sort of behavioral changes, you know, body changes, anything like that, because of ultimately that you're playing game or this video game to forget about some problem or other problems in real life that you don't want to cope with, and that it, you know, it, and it shouldn't be a substitute for it, and we really need to sort of trigger those sort of things when it comes to our children. But I think it's, you know, equally relatable to adult life. But again, you know, one great example she mentioned was around, you know, Pokemon Go, which is also a virtual game, but it gets people out. It gets people out in environment and in nature. And again, there is a real sort of community who you play with, be it, you know, your friends or family, or be it, you know, online community. So what about, you know, what are your thoughts on, you know, video games and these, you know, digital games and the value that they add to our lives and potentially professional environments? Because obviously, you know, ultimately at the moment, we are all virtual and we all meet in a virtual environment. And if organizations wanted to bring playfulness or fun or games within their environment, they would have to do it in a virtual setting one way or another.
Yeah, and I think that there's, you know, games have had a very bad rap at times and a very good rap at times, and it kind of, you know, alternates. I think that for me, and again, I've developed physical and digital games. There are kind of strengths and weaknesses, or rather challenges to all these forms. with digital video games, I think the challenge I found towards the end of the time I was spending at Lego developing them, is what we were up against at Lego, where we were trying to kind of create kind of as healthy or fun play as we could. You're up against these games that are engineered today about, for want of a better word, addiction. And the reason that gamification exists and kind of has risen to the fore in modern times is because what games did back in the day was there was no need to play a video game. Like, kids, you know, got into stuff, but there was, you know, it's not a fundamental need of life. It's not like food or warmth or any of the other kind of core drives we have. And so it competes with all of the other fun things, which is what we're doing to kind of relieve stress or pressure or to play, as it were. And so what they got very good at was how to then keep you in the game, stop you moving on, or to kind of actually find ways to keep you engaged. And particularly in the old days where, or the origins of video games, where you couldn't just do it with content. You know, you couldn't have these AAA games you have today with like 50, 70 hours of content or like hundreds or thousands of levels. These games were much simpler. And so they had to make you be able to kind of want to replay them, do the same things over and over and over again to get that value that you were paying for the game. And so they just worked out over time how to do this, what fundamentally, you know, triggered us, what made us kind of want to repeat things, what was fun effectively, particularly in a digital sense. And they got very good at it over time. And what the advent of mobile gaming, what that really did is it opened Pandora's box, because it took this these techniques that games had developed, and it was able to then expand them from, you know, hundreds of thousands of kind of gamers, as it was back then, into literally millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions. And so that kind of was a kind of step change and a leap change in the reach and also the data. So what previously had taken, you know, 40, 50 years to learn how to improve this gamification in how players thought or reacted to these stimulus, the feedback, the rewards, all these triggers that games had developed to keep you engaged in the play or the experience, just, you know, literally went over a kind of a data mountain, and there was just a spike. And I would love to kind of play back at some point, watch that kind of thing in a data flow, and just see how much data was gathered in that period from the iPhone launching for the next 5 years. And everything changed, like everything. And so nowadays, I feel this, particularly in digital games, something has been lost in that sense of fun and discovery and pure playfulness that existed in those old games. I think that now the majority of the games that are the big successful ones that effectively suck up all of the oxygen in the air in that space are, it doesn't mean they can't be fun to play or whatever. In fact, they have to be. But the way that they do so is effectively by playing on our triggers. They are addictive in a way that I believe in later years will be sanctioned, controlled, in the same way that cigarettes or alcohol or other forms, or gambling, other forms of highly addictive things are. And I think so. It doesn't mean that video games are bad, but there are certainly highly addictive video games in existence, and their the ability to access them has never been easier. And therein lies a problem. And I think that when you are trying to do something fun and playful and very much against that, that is what you are up against. And that can unfortunately mean it's very, very hard for those independent people who want to do the right thing to succeed.
So this is really interesting, and absolutely, you know, I can relate. I'm sure a lot of parents can relate about the fact that, you know, these video games are engineered to create a sense of addiction at a very young age. And that, you know, as you mentioned also, that we don't play games over and over again to create value just for fun. It's a real consumer behavior that we plant into our children at a very, very young age, that you start, you finish, and then you move on. There is no going back to it anymore. And that's, I think, a real, you know, consumer behavior. You know, we consume everything. You know, I'm not only talking about sort of, you know, the normal things that you would have food and those sort of things, but we consume news, we consume, and hence we've got, you know, disinformation and misinformation. We consume fashion, and same with games. In a slightly different and less physical manner, but it's still a real consumer behavior and a real data gather activity, as you mentioned as well. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, and I think it's still evolving, and it's evolving so fast that it is extremely hard to keep up with it, to be perfectly honest. But at the same time, there are some common arcs here that we see, and as again, I just really want to paint that picture that video games themselves are not bad, just like, you know, food is not bad, but there is bad food, right? There is food that is has little to no nutrition and is actually very unhealthy for you. That does not, just because food like that exists, does not make food bad. And it's the same with video games. There are incredible video games that can really teach you wonderful things, where you can experience incredible kind of stories and journeys and learning and all these other things. They can form some of the most compelling aspects of people's lives that they will keep coming back to year after year, and they will form some of the defining parts of people's characters or personalities. They are an incredible thing, and they're evolving as an art form and as a media and as a medium. So I don't want to come across as like ban video games, or kids should not play video games, or even adults. However, we just really need to be more aware and conscious of what an unhealthy video game looks like, how to identify it, and how to deal with it. And it doesn't mean you can't ever play it, just like it's perfectly okay to have a Mars bar or any other kind of sweet or type thing from time to time. But like we say with all these things, it's basically, we say in moderation, right? You know, it's okay to have a glass of wine. It's okay to have it, but in moderation. And the same needs to be true of these things. And we need to learn, coping mechanisms and mechanics to deal with this. And kids are actually both in a better and worse situation than us adults right now, because they are being exposed to these things to a much higher degree than we are as adults. So they are both, you're going to see both ends of the spectrum. Therefore, you're going to find kids that kind of build up an immunity, or build up a defense mechanism, or build up an understanding, and they will actually learn to cope. That's one extreme of the kids. But you're also going to find others at the other end who are maybe prone to addiction already, and they are going to suffer quite greatly and really struggle to find other aspects of life that can compete with games. When these games are engineered to give you kind of feedback and reward, it's like, you know, you start off and within 5 seconds, it's like, yes, you did it. Great. You know, succeed. You're on the next level. You're awesome. What kid does not like that, right? It's like, you could test anything. You could say like, okay, we'll line up 5 kids and we'll say to one kid, yeah, get on with it, or clean your room, and say to another kid, like, you're awesome. You leveled up. Do you want a big sword? Yeah. You know, it's as simple as that. They're going to love it. And when they get that, it's going to be better than like the feedback they get at school or from their folks or from their friends. It's just like, the game is designed just to tell them they're awesome and to make them feel awesome. It's going to match make them with opponents that they can beat enough times, and then throw in one that where they lose, just to feel like, oh, I need to get better, or I need to level up, or I need to spend money. But they are engineered to strike that balance between making you feel awesome and making you feel challenged. And that's often where we kind of come back to gamification, because people kind of go, you know, how could I do that to my employee? How can I make him feel like he or she is awesome, but is challenged and kind of like wants to kind of like get to the next level, whether that's promotion or skill building or whatever. And that's where it's kind of it comes from. And there are kind of there are people that understand this and can help companies with this in great ways. I do it in some forms, but there are others out there that I have worked with and know. For example, Yukai Chow. His book, Actionable Gamification, Beyond Points, Badges, and Leaderboards, is a fantastic starting point. It's not, I would say, a light read, but it's also not too heavy, and it has lots of instantly actionable kind of things. And he really breaks that down, that it's about behavior design. And the more we improve our ability to understand and affect and cause behavior, it's like the cleverer we get as businesses and industries and employers and achieving things and doing things. But it's a tricky balance, right? Because we've probably all seen some of the TV specials or kind of some of the reports behind social media networks and these balances and things going on where certain companies have taken behavioral design into behavioral programming effectively. And so with these great tools comes a great responsibility not to use them intentionally or unintentionally for the detriment of people, I believe. And of course they can and should be used for the betterment, but that's something needs to be trod lightly. And I think that's why you should involve experts in these fields to get the best results for ethical as well as financial and effectiveness reasons.
No, you're absolutely right, and you're absolutely, it is about behavioral design, because everything, and you said the right thing, you know, the game itself when it sits there is not a bad thing. You know, we could look at, you know, so many things that have been brought into our lives one way or another have changed our behaviors. Even if we think about, you know, I don't know, 50 or 100 years ago when people used to wash their clothes by hand, and then a washing machine arrived. And that suddenly changed behavior. It changed how we go about our days, because we had more time on our hands and we started doing other things. Same with social media. So we've moved from newspapers onto social media. And also, you know, the behavior that social media, for instance, design, you know, is achieved through those likes, through those shares, through those comments. So again, there is a certain, you know, behavior and affiliation that is trying to create. And again, you know, same for gaming. So absolutely, it's about, you know, behavior design, and hence for us, it's important to build that awareness and consciousness about it, because absolutely not, you know, all games are bad, but it's just being aware of which games do have potentially some insidious purposes, let's put it that way.
Yeah, and I think when we talk about like behavior design and stuff, there's you know, we have good and bad behaviors, and so you know, which kind of get pulled out or highlighted. And you know, games also don't have to be about winning, right? It should be about the play and the playing that should be the purpose, not the end result, as it were. It needs to be about the process. I always believe fantastic games are ones that are as much fun for the players that don't win as the ones that win. I think that when we look at game design, people always, if you ask someone like, why is this game fun? And they say, because when you win, or if any of the answer is related to the winning aspect, then for me, that's, you have to tell them, of course, it's fun to win. People like to win. That's not unique to one or any other game or so forth. So why is it fun to play and not win? Particularly when, if you sit down at any kind of game, there's going to be, if the game has a winning scenario, there's going to be a winner and lots of losers. It's one of the things I tried to teach my kids very early on. We like to play a lot of board games, and there's always this obviously frustration if you lose, or if you like lose more than once or in a row, or you keep getting beaten by an elder brother or sister or parent. And what you have to remind them is, you say, I break it down to them. I say, okay, when we sit down to play a game, how many of us are sat at the table? And we might say four or five. Okay. Now, in this game, you know, how many people can win? One. Okay. So before we've rolled a dice, picked up a card, done anything, what are your chances of winning? And they kind of can eventually, you know, do the math and say, okay, it's a 20% or 25% chance. And you say, yes. And what's your chances of losing? Okay, it's 75% or 80% in these, a lot of these games. Okay, so you're going to lose a lot. In fact, you're far more likely to lose every time than you are to win. Do you still want to play the game? And so, you know, if they say no, you need to say, well, then you're going to miss out on all the fun, because it is fun to play. But if your purpose or your driving behavior or how you're setting yourself up is that the purpose of play is to win, then you're setting yourself up for failure, because you are going to fail most of the time. And whereas if you can say the purpose is to have fun with my friends or to play or to experience this thing, to learn about the game, to kind of develop strategies, to see if I can improve, all of these other things, then you're setting yourself up to win. And then every time you win, regardless of when you actually win the game, you win in that learning process, in that togetherness, in that bonding experience.
I love that. I love that, you know, that you go into or you teach your children to go into these games with their eyes wide open and fully aware of what are their chances. And I guess to an extent, there is a little bit of a sense of peace, or you sort of find your peace with the fact that you might lose, even though it never is a great feeling. But that is that sort of that leaderboard syndrome, isn't it? Because there's only awards for winning to the winners, and the rest are just losers. And, you know, thanks for coming and thanks for attending, but the winners are the winners. And I think also in organizational setting, when there are these you know, once a year, these offsites where you take a team out and you play games. It is also, you know, often about that leaderboard, about, you know, there's one winner. There's not necessarily about, you know, coming together as a team and solving a problem together as a team. So that's also something to be mindful of. But I really like that example. Thank you for sharing. And I also loved the quote that you said, you know, with great tools comes great responsibility. And I'm sure I've heard that quote before somewhere, but it really, really fits this context and love it. Another thing that I wanted to touch on, and you already touched on it earlier, is around these sort of traditional mindsets. And I guess one of the problems is that we see play as a one-dimensional attribute. We see it as a board game or as a physical activity or a video game. You know, in association for a psychological science article, I came across three really interesting quotes that I'd like to read out. So the first is, play is play, fun is fun, and work is work. They're different. I work hard, even if it's supposed to be fun for someone else, it's work for me. The second is, I learned the value of hard work by working hard. And the third one is, sleeping is forbidden at age of 22. It's all work and no play. And these three quotes are from actor William Hurt, scientist Margaret Mead, and singer Usher. And all represent a fairly, a very traditional view of doing good work. You know, on one hand, you know, the author and psychiatrist Stuart Brown, in his book Play, compares play to oxygen. And he writes, it's all around us, yet goes mostly unnoticed or unappreciated until it is missing. And in this book, he encourages us to reflect on how play shows up in our lives. The play takes so many different forms. You know, it can be a game, it can be art, it can be a book, it can be sport, a movie, music, comedy, flirting, talking, and even daydreaming. And the point I'm trying to make is that play is still a fairly stigmatized topic in a work setting. And because of the traditional hierarchies, there could be these sort of conflicting views of what value does play really add, and whether organization, especially if we picture a traditional law or accounting office where everyone is suited and booted, their potentially dedication, work ethic, long working hours might be perceived as right, whereas play as something distracting and wrong. But you alluded to earlier, you know, play is not opposite to work, is it?
Absolutely not. And I think that there are different ways to approach this. And just to kind of add a quote to the ones you were saying, I think that as a counterpoint to that, Mark Twain, you may have heard this quote, but it says, find a job you enjoy doing and you'll never have to work a day in your life. And that was the approach that I've always taken, is that basically, you know, I don't really feel like I've ever kind of been to work, as it were, because I've always wanted to be there. Have kind of leapt out of bed to go there, whatever I've been doing, because that's how I've pursued things. And if I felt that that was not how I was feeling, then I felt like I was in the wrong, I had the wrong job. And so I've always pursued with that mentality, and the mentality that if I couldn't find something that kind of gave me that feeling, then I would kind of make it, build it. And that's kind of what I've been doing recently. But I think that that's, you know, it's what you call, for some, you could say, okay, that's a first world problem, or that's a luxury problem. Some people just need to put money on the table. And that is always, of course, true. I think, however, within that, you can try and find the playful path. And I think that you can approach things to say, how could I make this more enjoyable? And don't expect your boss or your company to do this for you. I think that if you can show that actually by being more playful, you are more productive, you are more active, you actually do your job better. That's going to be hard for many to kind of really deny at some point. But it is not an easy path. And so to quote what you're saying, I think I've worked very hard at being playful. I think that it's a worthy pursuit, and if you can achieve it to a certain level, you can spread that on, right? So you can share that path, and you can try and trailblaze and lead the way. Because, as you said, there are some industries that will be much slower than others to add that playful aspect to work. These, you know, I think the poster boys are what the Silicon Valley startups that kind of have this kind of like, it's all about play, right? And occasionally we get some work done. Build giant companies, and to the old kind of very old traditional, as you said, maybe accountancy firms or lawyer firms of the past, that might be, you know, it's all about seriousness and being at the desk and long hard work hours, and it's kind of, it's almost like you said, a badge of honor to like never smile or never appear like you're having a good time. Like if you came in and danced a jig or kind of like laughed out loud, it's like, it's almost like a fireable offense, right? It's like, who's that person, and get them out of here. And actually, I think you'll see that the opposite is true, that when you have one person, and I think everybody hopefully has had the benefit in their lives of meeting that kind of, or experiencing that person that's just playful through and through. They bring a kind of a smile to people's faces. They light up a room. They lift the kind of the mood and the energy. And yet, you know, and the positive influences of them is I think, you know, can be scientifically proven. You know, they lift moods and people kind of come away and they smile and they kind of get activated things. And yet these people are often then, looked down upon after the fact, right? Once that kind of like problem's passed, it's like, oh yeah, but you know, they don't take anything seriously and all this sort of thing. And so there's a lot of negativity to this mindset as well that we impose. And I think a lot of it comes from jealousy and fear, right? There's a fear that if I follow suit, it might backfire and on me. They can get away with it, but I can't. And then again, as I said, there's this jealousy that we're all kind of guilty of in many ways and forms. So there's this kind of feeling of like, you know, well, you know, they're having fun and I'm not. Therefore, you know, instead of admiring that, I kind of like hate on it, and might maybe even actively try and prevent them from having that fun or having that freedom or whatever it is that's making them feel like they're being playful. And so I feel that's unfortunately, and that mentality creeps into these meeting rooms, right, where it's much easier to shoot down someone's idea than it is to get behind it and help build upon it. And so this negative culture creeps in, and this is one of the reasons why creativity and innovation is very challenging and very difficult within these organizations, because effectively most of them are led by not a culture of play but a culture of fear. And as I started with, fear is the opposite of play. And so if you want your people to be more playful and through that more productive, happier, you know, less anxiety, you know, if people are passionate about their work, they will produce the goods. They will produce them faster, better, more innovative than ever before. But to do that, they need to be free of fear. And freedom from fear does not mean freedom from responsibility. Quite the opposite. I believe that if people are passionate about what they do, they care about it, they'll be far more professional and responsible than if they are simply doing it with a figurative gun to their head, right? Out of fear of their job or their boss or their rules or their culture.
I love that. You know, the work is not the opposite to play. Fear is. And I guess if the fundamental or the very fabric that your work or business is built on or your leadership is built on is fear, then probably work is the opposite of play in that context. But I also liked what you said about the fact that, you know, don't always, you know, expect that your own company will do this for you. So in the context of, you know, bring play into the work environment. And often we see that in business environments is that often you have to prove it before you get the support or the funding or, you know, endorsements by leadership, anything like that behind it. So often you have to do the legwork before that already. And before we wrap up this conversation, it's been, you know, so much that we've talked about and it has been, you know, brilliant. But this year, the Gallup 2020 World Happiness Report rated Finland as the most happiest country for the third year, with Denmark as second and Switzerland as the third. But obviously Denmark has always, you know, everyone has known that Denmark is this sort of happy place or this happy country where people live in. So obviously you have lived in several countries in Europe. So what I'm very curious about is what makes Denmark a happy place to live in for you? You know, do they bring play in their, I don't know, government structures? What are the things that set them apart from other places in Europe or perhaps in the world to live in?
I actually think that it does relate back to exactly what we've just been saying. I would say that there is actually a lot less fear here. There is a kind of, you know, very good health system. There is very good education system sort of thing, which is all paid for from like taxes and so forth. But it means that if you are, you know, not earning, then there is a good welfare system. And if you're not earning, you're not being taxed. So when you are earning, then people are more able to or manage to pay that tax. Because it's a very high tax here. You actually, I feel you really see where that goes. You know, it's, you know, there's the police or the schools or all the places you think it should go. I feel like it goes here. So you kind of, you see that your tax dollars at work and therefore it's more, you're more comfortable paying it. And all of those things, I think, go towards things that like allay your fears. And I think that's what governments like say they can do. They can't kind of, government can't make you happy, but what it can do is it can tackle some of your fears, right? So some of the things that make you unhappy. And that should be the when that's the role of government and they actually take it that way, they say, how can we make people feel, you know, safer in their homes, safer in their workplaces, safer about kind of having that kind of passion or that energy to pursue a career that they want to, not what, you know, they feel they have to. And so combine that with, I think, like a very high minimum wage and with the tax that goes up the more you earn, there's this kind of, I don't know, wider middle bracket that I see here where you might have a street of people living on the street like where I live, and you might, one might be a painter and one might be like IT person, somebody might be in like management in the company, and they're all very different careers they might have, but they all have an almost identical house and car and kids going to the same school and so forth. So there's a very kind of leveling thing, unless you have that kind of that top 5%. So that kind of evens things out. So it really means that like you can afford to pursue a job that makes you happy or that you want to do, because it won't necessarily pay much more or much less than the next job, right? So and with a kind of smaller population, there is, you know, less competition for jobs than in other places. And I think those combine. But I would really say that fundamentally it's like there is less fear here. And as I said, fear is the enemy of play and fun, and are therefore, I think, very linked to happiness. So I believe that's one of the strongest things that, from my perspective.
That's brilliant. And exactly as I said, you know, well, first of all, this is a great example of where removing sense of fear works and how it works in sort of, you know, in a whole country sort of level in government capacity. And ultimately, as I said, you know, government can't make you happy, but what they can do, they can at least create an environment where there are less things to worry about, so you can make yourself, you know, happier in, you know, and sort of make your life more playful, whatever it might, you know, look like for you. And I think that so very, you know, brilliant note to finish our conversation on as well. So Cephas, I'll say a huge thank you for being on the show and talking to me and sharing all of your wealth of experience over years and years that you've acquired from being so passionate about play from a very early early stage. And obviously you've been for 12 years behind some of the people's favorite toy, Lego, ultimately. So it's really been great tapping into your expertise and you sharing, you know, all of these brilliant gems. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much, Pai. Happy to help, and hope that it kind of gives people some insights into play from a different perspective and open some minds and some doors to a more playful path forward.
Pablo Picasso once said, "All children are artists. The problem is how to remain an artist once one grows up." Cephas and I looked at today's topic from various lenses, but the message remains. Allowing play in the workplace is good for business and employees. It's a win-win. The opportunity to play on the job shows employees that they are valued and helps them lead more balanced lives. Employees are more engaged, collaborative, focused, more creative, and ultimately perform better. By encouraging play at work, it increases job satisfaction and general employee happiness. And happier workers have shown to be more productive and increase profits to the company. Ultimately, I hope that listening to this episode has inspired you to pull out and dust off that good old board game. And if you're contemplating on how to bring more playfulness and fun into your workplace, please connect with Cephas and speak to him on how he can help you with this. His details are in the show notes. As usual, you'll find my details in the show notes also, so get in touch with me to find out how I can help your organization with building a more inclusive and equitable workplace through raising cultural intelligence and better equipping your leaders. Thank you again for joining me on today's episode, and I look forward to have you back again next week when we will be exploring AI ethics. But in the meanwhile, stay safe, and until next time.